We've got some exciting news. Blood Ties is coming to CrimeCon 2021. It takes place on the 12th and 13th of June in London, and tickets are on sale now.
It's the ultimate true crime weekend. So join us, along with a host of other podcasters, authors, journalists, filmmakers and professionals, to talk all things true crime. Visit the website, crimecon.co.uk, to get more info and to book your tickets. And use the code BLOOD to claim your ticket discount.
We cannot wait to see you there. We'll be part of a Q&A, meet and greet, and hosting a live podcast.
And in the meantime, do be careful out there.
I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Very good that you're there. You know how much we appreciate you, and we always love the messages and the suggestions and the, well, just the feedback.
Cannot tell you how good the old Instagram's been this week.
Wonderful.
I put a plea out. Can we get to 1,000 followers? You guys have been amazing. Loads of people have followed us. We're so nearly there. Hold on, let me just check.
Thank you all.
And tell you what the updated figure is. 969.
Well, my goodness.
So close.
So it's only 31 away from 1,000.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And also, thanks everyone for being really kind about my voice when I said that I had a silly voice last week, and everyone's been really nice about it. My particular favourite was a gentleman who wrote in and said, "I've never written in before, but I'm writing now to say your voice is fine."
Of course it is, Mo. I think so you're unnecessarily sensitive.
That was very kind of all of you, and all of your messages have been so nice, and we appreciate it so much. I can't get over it. It was such a nice bunch.
Yeah, wonderful bunch.
What a nice bunch of people.
Well, I've had most amazing emails and extraordinary suggestions and thank you, and we really like it, and go to keep doing it. And of course, it's not just, by no means is it just in Britain. It's all over the world.
I know, can't believe it.
Mm.
And this is a huge podcast. We've got so much news.
Mm.
One, this is podcast number 100. Can't believe it.
Neither can I.
Also, our three-year anniversary, three-year annie, almost.
I can't believe that either.
Can't believe it. 3 years, 100 podcasts.
No.
What have we been doing?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We've been locked down.
We're going to CrimeCon.
We are. We're going to CrimeCon 2021, held in London. Don't worry if you're concerned about COVID. There's a full refund policy which gives you your money back. And the more of you come and buy a ticket, we get a discount.
You can use our code BLOOD when you book your ticket.
Yeah.
And please do that, because then they know that you booked it because of us.
Yes.
And that means that we get something special. I don't know what we get.
Yes.
One free night at a hotel.
No, probably a bag of licorice all sorts. Or possibly...
We don't need
guns.
A night at a hotel because we live in London anyway.
No, we don't.
But we're very excited to have been invited.
Yeah, very.
You can come and meet us. We're doing a meet and greet.
Yep.
And come and say hi to us. We'll sign your T-shirts.
Yes.
We as yet don't have merchandise, but perhaps we will by 2021.
We never know. Be good fun.
We could have a T-shirt, couldn't we?
Could have a T-shirt.
A mug.
Oh, a T-shirt. Certainly.
Yeah. Okay, we'll work on that.
And we will. We'd have to ask George, wouldn't we?
Yeah, we would, to use his picture, yeah. But I think it would be worth it.
But I think the whole concept that we've been going for as long as we have is remarkable. I find it astonishing. I didn't think, well, when you suggested this to me, I didn't even know what a podcast was.
No.
And here we are, 100 later.
I know, can you believe it?
It's extraordinary.
We've got some other big news. Our Patreon page launches today.
Does it, by Jove?
So go and check out Blood Ties on Patreon.
How do you spell Patreon?
Geoffrey putting me on the spot, and I don't want to get it wrong. So I'm going to Google it, because that's what young people do.
It's Patron.
Patreon.
Yes. It's a play on patronage, isn't it?
On. Okay, I got it.
Okay.
Patreon.
Patreon.
Go to patreon.com. And search Blood Ties, and you'll find us there. And then, yeah, go and check it out. See what's avail.
Yes, because we recorded all sorts of special stuff for it.
We did a bunch of videos. So if you choose to be a member of the different sections, you get a special little vid.
Yes.
Which mainly were stories about Jeffrey at Jeffrey's expense.
They were all about me at my expense.
Well, I had to come up with them on the spot, so, you know.
I should have told them one about you and giving me a grumpy mug.
Why do you keep going on about the grumpy mug? I've given you so many other nice mugs in this
interim. I've still got the grumpy mug. I've
given you mugs from, you know,
this is
Disney World.
I have to say, my friends, this was a very, very long time ago.
Yeah, I don't even remember it. That's how long ago it was.
I mean, I think Molly was 13 or 14. It's a long, long time ago.
About the time I would have found you grumpy.
Yes, exactly. I think every father of a 13-year-old teenager or 14-year-old teenager daughter is by definition grumpy, especially me. But it's been great fun, and this has been an absolute delight to do this podcast. And I think it's absolutely opened my eyes to what an extraordinary world there is out there. Especially people fascinated by true crime, as I am. And I think it's very important and I think significant that we've chosen for the 100th podcast probably the most famous of the murders of the 20th century.
This is my... I said to Jeffrey last week, can we do a cult?
And I said, well, the most logical cult to do is Helter Skelter, the Manson family.
So we're doing a two-parter on the Manson family, right? So we're doing Charles Manson first.
That's right.
And then we're doing Helter Skelter.
Yes.
Which is the actual crimes, is that right?
Well, the cult was named by Manson, Helter Skelter, in the wake of the Beatles' White Album, which included a song called Helter Skelter. In fact, a lot of the inspiration for... the cult came from songs. And Manson was an interesting sort of fringe figure on the LA music scene. But let's pause and
go.
Start.
And so what are we calling this part one?
I think we call part one Charles Manson.
Charles Manson. Okay, here we go. Charles Manson.
Charles Manson, I find one of the most frightening and hypnotic figures in true crime in the 20th century. Ironically, he didn't actually kill anyone, although he was convicted of conspiring to kill. He asked others or urged others to do it. In fact, last night I dreamt about him, and I very seldom dream about what I'm going to do in a podcast. There's something about him that is genuinely frightening. He exercised an extraordinary control over people, particularly his followers, who became known as the family. But let's begin at the beginning. Manson was born on the 12th of November, 1934, in Cincinnati. He was the illegitimate child of a 16-year-old girl called Kathleen Maddox. And Manson was originally known as Charles Miles Maddox. His real father was a con man who disappeared as soon as Kathleen was pregnant. He just upped and vanished. And Manson never knew him. Before Manson was born, however, Kathleen married a man called William Manson, hence the name Charles Manson, who was a labourer and had a brother called Luther. Now, that's important because William Manson, Manson's adopted father, was fairly rough, and his brother Luther was equally rough. And in fact, Kathleen, who had become, well, not surprisingly, unsteady, these days we'd probably call unstable, got involved in crime. And in 1939, in August, Kathleen and Luther, her brother-in-law, are arrested for armed robbery and assault. She gets 5 years and Luther gets 10 years. Manson is sent to stay with an aunt and uncle. To call Manson's childhood disturbed would be a gross understatement. It could hardly have been harsher. When Kathleen was paroled in 1942, Manson was still only 9. She went back to, she went to live with the aunt and uncle that he'd been staying with, but I'm afraid she by now was a bit of a drunk. And believe it or not, in August 1943, she married a man she'd met at an AA meeting. An interesting choice of partner. According to Manson himself, at the age of 9, which would have been in 1943, he set fire to his school.
Classic arson.
Classic portrait of a serial killer.
Pre-serial killer.
But he was, whether he actually did it or not, he certainly claimed it later in his life. But he certainly got in trouble for truancy and petty theft. At 1947, at 13, he was sent to a home for delinquents in Indiana. He literally shuttles from home to foster home to... the school, the one he's sent to in Indiana, is very strict, and he runs away on a number of occasions. He's a small boy. He's not even a teenager yet. And goes back to his mother and aunt and uncle, but the mother takes him back to the school. She doesn't... You know, as far as she's concerned, he's off her hands. And besides, she has other fish to fry. To be fair to Manson, after he left the Indiana delinquent home, he tried to get straighten himself up. And he was a delivery. He worked on deliveries for a while. But as was so often to be the case in Manson's life, and his young life in particular, he just fell into petty theft. And on one particular occasion, he steals a car and drives across the state line. He's caught, and this time he's sent to the really quite famous place, Boys Town, in Omaha, Nebraska, which was another home for delinquent children. Guess what? He ran off with a fellow inmate and turned to armed robbery. Then he's sent to an Indiana boys' school where he was allegedly, and again, this is slightly blurred, raped by other boys, having been encouraged to do so. They have been having been encouraged to do so by a member of staff. He ran away 18 times. He'd been, by this time, clearly discovered to be illiterate, but with actually quite a high IQ of about 109, 110. And in 1951, he finally escaped with two other inmates. But before he escaped, he developed what he called the insane game. He wasn't physically very strong and certainly wasn't a big boy, young man, so he used to pretend to be mad. He looked, eyes wide and funny voices and, you know, having jitters and in an effort to protect himself. It was his way of defending himself. Well, in 1951, he runs away. By now, in 1951... he escapes with two other boys and they steal a car and set off for California. Once again, they get caught. This time it's a federal crime. He's looking at more jail time. By now, he's become, I suppose you could call it, institutionalised. I mean, he's really not known any other life, particularly, except institutions. he starts to attack boys with rape them at knife point. All you can say is that it was horrendously mixed up, and I'm being as benevolent as I possibly can to a man whom I really do find terrifying. He knew no restraint. But believe it or not, in 1955, in January 1955, at the age of 21, he gets married to a girl called Rosalie Willis, who works as a hospital waitress. By the time Charles Jr. is born in 1956, Manson's back in jail. More armed robbery. And there's also a whole deal about cashing a federal check. So they give him probation. Unless if he breaks the law again, then he's going to get the full term, 5 years. In September 1958, Manson, now in his 20s, is divorced by Rosalie. Not really surprisingly, to be honest. But something has happened to Manson. He's realised that he is extraordinarily charismatic, particularly to young women. The whole gist of what was to become the family is built in this almost innate attraction to young women. It's a variant of the insane game. He just has that ability. It's almost hypnotic, that ability to stare into a young woman's eyes and make her do what he wants. By now, he's grown his hair a bit. The early photos of Manson make him look rather sort of weak and feeble.
I'm just going to look him up.
The early mugshots, the famous mugshots, are the ones in the 60s. But the early ones, he doesn't look anything much at all. Well, he's eventually arrested for pimping a young woman. And the old crime of the Treasury check comes back to haunt him. And he's sent to jail for 10 years. By the time of his release, in March 1967, he has spent more than half his 32 years in prisons and institutions. In fact, legend has it that when his release came round in March 67, he said to the prison staff, "I don't know how I'll be able to live anywhere else. I want to stay here."
I'm not surprised.
So you have a young man who has been, well, to put it politely, scarred. But what happens next, what goes on to happen, is horrifying. Manson gets out of jail in March 1967. He doesn't know anywhere else. He doesn't know quite what to do. But, and here's the big but, he has realised that he has this extraordinary attraction to young women. Amazing. Well, but we also ought to go back and describe 1967. 1967 is the summer of love, hippies, flower power. The Beatles have released Magical Mystery Tour, the White Album. We're at the height of San Francisco and the hippie rebellion. I can remember writing about it only too vividly. I seem to write about
Were you wearing flares with long hair and all that?
I was, yes, yeah. And beads. Yes, I was a very unlikely reporter for the Times when I got there. I used to stick flowers on my desk, you know, ones you stick on.
Amazing.
Yeah. So gradually, during 1967, he surrounds himself with a group of people of sort of like-mindedness, a couple of men, Charles Tex Watson and a man called Bobby Beausoleil, and a number of girls, including Susan Atkins, Patricia Kernwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten. So they become a sort of little commune. You know, it's, if looking back, I mean, it was very fashionable at the time, especially in California, to join a commune. You know, all live together, share one another, a lot of free love, plenty of cannabis, and a generally what you might describe as relaxed lifestyle. It was by no means unusual, but finally, Manson and a few members of his family, this is the prototypical family, it's not quite called that yet, but it's that's what's developing, they buy an old school bus and decorate it with flowers and paint, you know, psychedelics and all of the rest. And they set off from San Francisco on what they call their own magical mystery tour. Another tribute to the Beatles. In 68, they end up in LA. They've driven, not quickly, no, down the coast. And the late spring of 68, two of the girls in the family are hitchhiking in Malibu, just outside Los Angeles, when they're picked up by really a very famous musician, Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys.
Hello.
And they go to live in Wilson's house. So other members of the family have gone to stay in what used to be a sort of proto-film studio on outside LA called the Spahn Ranch. And it was what you might describe as Manson becomes this sort of minor figure on the fringes of the LA music scene. He's introduced to Wilson. Wilson introduces him to a famous producer, Terry Milchett, who had produced for the Byrds and Mamas and Papas, all sorts of California groups, very well known, who at that time was staying in a house in Cielo Drive, 10,050 Cielo Drive, in Los Angeles itself. Gradually, during 68, Manson develops his concept of a cult completely. He says, effectively, to the followers, look, I believe that there's going to be a race war. It's going to be, he's going to call it a doomsday cult. There's going to be a race war in which all the black people will rise up and kill all the white people except Manson and his family, because the black people need leadership.
Right.
That's the basis of the cult. And he names the cult Helter Skelter, in using, he also used the Book of Revelations a lot in the indoctrination of his family. But Beatles songs and the Book of Revelations are two of the hallmarks of the Manson family.
Quite an odd combo.
It is quite. But Manson adopts Helter Skelter. And throughout the beginning of 1969, by this time, incidentally, Dennis Wilson and Melchett have severed all ties with Manson because they realise that he actually is very strange indeed. Manson starts to effectively indoctrinate his family into the idea that they can help incite the race war that he believes is coming, that they can kill and make it look like black people have been doing the killing. It is.
Why would you do that?
Well, he
just
wants
for the pleasure of killing.
Well, he wants that, but he also believes, in this completely misguided way, that he's going to be chosen as the leader of whatever remains after this apocalyptic race war.
Right.
This becomes increasingly intense in the first half of 1969. So much so that all the members of the family, the close members of the family, of which there were really seven, are absolutely certain that Manson is telling the truth, that he has some kind of exceptional insight, that he knows more about what's going to happen in the world than anyone else. And by now, you have what I think is the most famous of the pictures of Manson, which is his very staring eyes, hair, black hair, almost like a halo, and this extraordinary, almost hypnotic look. You can see how Manson could have affected the lives of impressionable young people. He was older, for example. He was the oldest. And
was it mainly women in the...
No, there were two significant men, a third more on the edge, and there were three significant women.
How many people were in the family?
Well, it varied a little, but around seven at any one time. So what you have is literally a bizarre, extraordinary conviction that they are going to be able to sort of lead the world out of its apocalyptic race war by inciting it and then leading it. It is a completely misguided, utterly wrong, and yet we are in a time in which there are a lot of odd theories about how you had to live in the world. There was one of them, ones was you must take lots of LSD because that's where you can see the truth. You know, drugs were a part of it, but it wasn't just that. There was also that there was a train of thought in Manson. I'm not saying for a moment that Manson was entirely sane, but equally he wasn't insane. There was a rationale, a way of looking at the world that he had convinced his followers was real. And so by July 1969, you have a petri dish of hate fueled by Manson, injected into his followers, and he incites them to kill. He wants them to kill to incite the race war. Well, one of the group commits the first of the killings. He's called Bobby Beausoleil, and he kills a man called Gary Hinman. I'm afraid none of the killings were very well planned. They were all pretty much, how can I put it, almost at will. It's extraordinary how dreadful and how inexplicable most of this was. Even now, looking back, it was horrifying, depraved, disgusting, perfectly ordinary, suggestible young people were encouraged to commit crimes of the most awful depravity. I'm just trying to remind myself of the exact date of the first thing. I think it's the 29th of July, 1969. Anyway, Bobby Beausoleil kills Hinman and guess what? Steals his car. It takes the cops about 2 days
to find him.
Find him driving Hinman's car. I mean, we are not talking about the brightest knife, or
sharpest tool in the toolbox.
No, I mean, it's horrific. But never mind. To some extent, that first killing, the Bobby Beausoleil killing, is the trigger to what then becomes known as the Helter Skelter killings.
Oh.
So let's come back to that.
Part two.
Part two.
Super. Thanks, Dad. Charles Manson. How interesting.
Yes. There's a lot of things that people don't know about Manson, I think.
Mm.
He had a very... He seems just like this figure of evil that is kind of bandied
He's
around.
He's sort of portrayed so much in media and in stories and all sorts, isn't he?
Well, he's probably the preeminent killer in the 20th century.
He's in Mindhunter.
Yes,
he's
he is.
In Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Very much so.
Or is he actually in it? Or is just the... He's not, is he?
No,
just
he's not. Doesn't make an appearance. Although his influence is everywhere.
Yeah.
And there's some very interesting things I'll come back to when we get to the last killings myself. The Manson casts a very long, dark shadow over crime, particularly in the second half of the 20th century. Even compared to the other horrifying killers, whether it's Gacy, whether it's Jeffrey Dahmer, whether it's Bundy, there's something about Manson that's even bigger.
Yeah.
Certainly in terms of his reputation. It's almost as though you only need to say the word Manson and
that's
people
true.
Shiver.
Yeah.
You know, there have been more prolific killers. Indeed, as I said at the beginning, Manson himself was never convicted of murder, only of conspiracy to commit murder. And it's pretty certain that he never actually killed anybody. But nevertheless,
he was
synonymous
making with killings happen. Killing.
Anyway, let's try and talk about
something
cheerful. Sorry. Yes, it is. I think it is. The background is interesting.
Hmm.
You know, if you think about it in terms of the Summer of Love and hippies and all that and what it was like.
I was obsessed with hippies. Do you remember?
I do.
I mean, I was so into it.
Yeah, you had a wonderful Afghan coat.
I still have it.
You still got it? Mine. Wow.
Yeah, I had a red sort of... It wasn't an Afghan coat. It was a red suede coat with a sheepskin trim.
Oh, okay. Oh, I was thinking the one we bought in Glasgow.
No, that's that one.
Oh, the same one.
It was red suede.
Red
with
suede.
A white with a sheepskin trim.
Yeah.
I bought all my clothes from vintage stores.
Yeah.
I had like... I bought my first pair of flares from Kensington Market, which doesn't exist anymore.
No.
They were purple cord flares.
Yeah.
And
those were the days.
I took them when I started secondary school, I remember vividly.
Yes.
And I had... There was a shoe shop in the village where we lived, or little town sort of near where we lived, run by this man who never threw anything away. And so he had all these original shoes from the 60s and 70s. And because I have tiny feet, he had left these tiny ones. I had a pair of wedged Mary Jane sort of platform. Yeah, they were like brown, a bit like brogues, I guess, but with buckles. And they had three buckles and a wedge.
Uh-huh.
And I also had a pair of blue, sparkly platform boots, knee-high boots from the 70s.
Wonderful.
Amazing. And I wore cheesecloth
and
flares,
oh.
And I had a yin-yang and a peace sign. And
oh, yes.
I had all the stuff.
Yeah, you certainly did.
And I desperately wanted a Beetle and a camper van. And yeah, I was...
Yes.
I was really into it.
Yeah. And then you went to Ireland with some friends and lived in a caravan with a horse drawing it.
I did go in a horse-drawn caravan around Ireland, yeah.
Yes, it's wonderful.
That wasn't during my hippie phase.
No, that was after.
That was after.
Yeah, but no, I think your teenage years are much marked by hippies and hippiness.
I was just so into it.
But thankfully, not into the Manson family.
Like Jeffrey, I committed to a theme with them clothes.
Yes.
Back then.
Yep, I commit to a theme. It's always a good idea. How's your week been?
Oh, fine.
Yeah.
Not much to report, really.
No, I've read a couple of really good books, including one which is causing a great controversy. The latest Cormoran Strike, Troubled Blood, written by Robert Galbraith, also known as J.K. Rowling, which the trans community have objected to because the serial killer is depicted, dresses up as a woman, to abduct his victims.
I mean, that doesn't go well with all that trans tweeting issue that she got herself into, does it?
No, but in fact, if you judge the book on simply on the book and leave the issue to one side, she's a fine storyteller.
Yeah, and she's got, I mean...
And Strike is a good character, and so is Robin.
I love you a bit of Harry Potter.
You know, the... and if anything, this gives you much more backstory to Strike and Robin than we've ever had before. The one downside to that is the book's enormous. 940 pages.
Oh, that's far too long. She loves a long book, doesn't she?
Yeah, but it is enormous. But I have to say, really remarkably well done. I don't have any trouble at all with it. But I've been reading that, and I'm reading a new John Banville called Snow, which is very good indeed. And a thing called The Postscript Murders by Ellie Griffiths, which is a lovely little idea about a lady, a very elderly lady, called Peggy Smith, who helps crime writers think up ideas for murder.
That's so cute.
She's a murder expert, and she's 90.
That could be you, Dad.
And the crime writers are always, you know, thanking her in the acknowledgements. And it gradually emerges that there's something much darker at play. It's a very, very
nice idea.
And Ellie Griffiths is very talented indeed. So that's been my week. I haven't watched a lot of anything very dramatic. I watched the second series of Dirty John, which I don't like as much as the first, but it's still good. And other than that, well, it's been quiet.
Hmm.
Yes.
Well, On that note,
we'll thank everyone.
Thank you to all the people that help us. Our producer, Sam Brain, Audio Boom, who hosts us. My brother, Dan, who did the music. My friend, George, who drew our caricature. To Jeffrey for his hard work. And to you, the listeners. Without you, we're nothing. And you're all so lovely.
You are.
I know I said it at the beginning, but I'm just going to say it again. I think you're all great.
Me too. And I'm incredibly grateful that you take the trouble to listen. I should also, of course, thank Molly because this was her idea. And
don't thank me for anything, Dan.
Oh, absolutely. I intend to, relentlessly. it was Mo's idea and Mo encouraged me. And here we are, 3 years and 100 podcasts later, still doing it. So
time for a glass of champagne, I'd say.
Yes. Thank you all for listening. And as I say often, bad things happen to good people. So please, please be careful out there.
I think it's the other way around, Dad. Oh, didn't you say?
Bad things happen to good people, I said. Okay. I got it right.